James Niedermayer, it's A18-0690. And counsel, when you're ready to argue, please approach the podium. It goes up and down. State your name for the record. 15 minutes for both sides with 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Counsel, are you ready?
As ready as I'll ever be, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Glenn Bruder and I represent the appellant in this matter, Timothy Niedermayer. Today the appellant challenges his convictions for one count of first degree criminal sexual conduct involving a child whose initials are KJK and one count of second degree criminal sexual conduct involving a child whose initials are ARJ. Both of these children are the offspring of the appellant's former fiance, a woman named Jennifer Conroy. The appellant raises several challenges to his conviction. In my presentation today, I plan on focusing on the first claim raised in the appellant's brief, which is that the trial judge's decision to depart from the language of the complaint when instructing the jury essentially deprived the appellant of due process and amounted to an improper amendment of the complaint under Rule 17.05 because it essentially gutted the defense that had previously been raised by the appellant's trial counsel.
And that defense was?
That defense essentially, Your Honor, centered on the timing. The complaint itself states that the acts of criminal sexual conduct occurred on or about April 1, 2015. The complaint in the narrative section, which the complaint is in the addendum to my client's brief, but in the narrative section, the complaint repeatedly states that that these events occurred in the spring of 2015.
It says April of 2015.
Correct, Your Honor.
In several locations.
That is correct, Your Honor. And that's the language that the defense counsel seized upon at trial. Essentially, this is a he said, she said case. There are no witnesses. There's no physical evidence.
There are witnesses.
The children are.
Sure.
Yeah, but they're the complainants.
They're witnesses, too.
All right, let me put it this way. There are no third-party witnesses, Your Honor. There's no observations of these events.
But the state, in its brief, points to the closing argument that was made on behalf of your client at the trial, which really attacked the credibility of the children.
The closing argument was made, but I believe it was made after the, I wasn't there, but I'm virtually certain that it was made after appellant's counsel was aware of the judge's change of the language in his jury instruction.
But it wasn't that the state was unable to prove that the offense or offenses occurred on or about a specific date, i.e. in April of 2015.
Well, I think my point is he couldn't make that argument because by that time he knew that the judge had already changed the language of the instruction. So on the fly, he had to shift to a different strategy. And clearly, if you look at the motion that defense counsel made for a judgment of acquittal at the conclusion of the state's case, he absolutely focused on the date of the offense in that argument. The judge indicated, yes, I understand that. You can save it for your final argument. Of course, when the judge changed the jury instruction, that argument was essentially emasculated. And that is, in fact, the basis for the challenge here. The defense counsel made a tactical.
So let me see if I understand what you're saying about the motion for judgment of acquittal, because I can appreciate that that would be a good indication of what the defense was. So help me out there. How would you characterize it based on the motion for judgment of acquittal? That the abuse did not occur because...
The abuse did not occur because it could not have occurred in April 2015.
Because yeah.
The parties, that the children were very clear that the offenses occurred during the time that their mother lived with Mr. Niedermeyer. And Ms. Conroy's testimony at the trial...
And that's where you confuse me, because even the probable cause statement, which is, in, I think, based in large measure on the interviews that were done of the victims, does allege multiple, at least in the case of KK, alleges multiple instances of abuse over a period of time, both at the mother's home as well as at Mr. Niedermeyer's home.
That's
so
correct.
I guess I'm confused why that would be your defense, because that doesn't seem to be the evidence that the state is putting forward.
Actually, Your Honor, it's very fact-specific, and this was an unusual situation.
Okay.
Prior to the parties' cohabitation, Mr. Niedermeyer owned a home in Maplewood. The parties decided to live together, and they rented a home in Oakdale. Mr. Niedermeyer did not sell his home in Maplewood. He simply moved into the home in Oakdale with Ms. Conroy, her family, and frankly, a host of other people, which created the issues, which made it a short-term cohabitation. So from April of 2014, for approximately 6 weeks or so, the parties did live together at the house in Oakdale. And at that point, according to her trial testimony, Ms. Conroy said the parties separated again, and Mr. Niedermeyer returned to his home in Maplewood. However, during the time the parties lived together, Mr. Niedermeyer would go back and forth to his home in Maplewood because he apparently kept his dog at his home in Maplewood the entire time.
Well, it's more than Mr. Niedermeyer going back and forth, isn't it? Isn't there testimony at trial as well that the mother and KK and perhaps some of the other children also spent evenings in Mr. Niedermeyer's home?
Your Honor, I don't recall that. I'm not saying it wasn't that there wasn't testimony about that. There was testimony that there would be trips back to Mr. Niedermeyer's home to take care of the dog, to do household chores. KJK did say that she went back to help Mr. Niedermeyer take care of his dog during the period of time when the parties lived together.
And of course, these are factual disputes that typically, if there's evidence on, we're going to just leave that to the jury. And so I'm not trying to ask you to, you know, re-argue that part of the case. I am trying to understand your point, which is how was the district court's instruction to the jury, which said, you know, the elements may be proven if the abuse occurred on or before April of 2015, how did that prejudice your client's defense when the evidence against your client included multiple instances over a period of time, and that went way back to the complaint. That was included in the probable cause statement in the complaint.
Except in the narrative section of the complaint, Your Honor, it consistently says all of this occurred in April of 2015 or on or about April
1, I don't know if it's consistent. So you're talking about the probable cause statement? It does say in April of 2015, but it also says with respect to KK that KK reported that the defendant on multiple occasions had pulled down her pants and underwear or put his hand down her pants, and it goes on from there, including instances of assaults at the Heron Lake home or in the residence in Maplewood. And so there are multiple instances over a period of time that are discussed in the probable cause statement. Again, getting back to the jury instruction, how's your client prejudiced?
I respectfully disagree with that. It does allege multiple acts. However, it doesn't say it was over an extended period of time. The complaint certainly says it occurred in a concentrated period of time, on or about April 1, 2015. Okay. And the defense strategy in this case was to focus on that and show that it could not have possibly occurred on or about April 1, 2015, because that is inconsistent with the children's allegation that the offenses occurred while Mr. Niedermeyer was living at the home, because Mr. Niedermeyer was not living at the home on or about April 1, 2015. Now, I may not have
Let me ask you a slightly different question, because our time does tend to go quickly, and I know you've made a fairly specific argument about the judge acting improperly under the rules of criminal procedure, 1705, right, and viewing this, what happened in the jury instructions, as an amendment to the complaint. And I just want to make sure I follow your analysis. You seem to rely on the Guerra decision quite a bit. I could be saying that wrong. But in that opinion, it looks to me as though the definition of an amended complaint, and this happens in other case law in Minnesota as well, would be one where it is an added or different charge. And that's, again, where I'm struggling to see the application of 1705 to what happened here, because it doesn't look to me as though there was an added or different charge. It was all the same charge, and only one charge, right? Only one charge of abuse was made. There could have been, perhaps, more charges based on the evidence, but there was only one charge submitted for KK to the jury.
Your Honor, I think it's pronounced Guerra.
Okay, thank you.
It's Court
I appreciate
of Appeals
that.
Decision, yep. So I'm going to defer mm-hmm. to you. But
don't do that on pronunciation. So, but go right ahead.
it is quoted at page 13 of my brief, and I think Guerra is enlightening here, because I couldn't find any case which had exactly this sort of circumstances. But in Guerra, the trial judge determined that he would essentially change the date of the offense from January 30, 1996 to December 1995.
I don't think I can agree with you on that, counsel. I don't think the amendment in Guerra was a change of the date of the offense. There's actually a completely different charge that's submitted to the jury.
Well, you know, I quote what this court said, you know, how this court characterized the judge's actions is quoted at page 13 of my brief. And essentially, there were more issues in Guerra. I concede that. I mean, there were firearms versus weapons, but he also changed the date of the offense and did it after the state had rested its case. And this court said that was impermissible. It was an impermissible amendment of the complaint. My argument is that this was even more egregious, because the trial judge didn't do it only after the state had rested its case. If this issue had arisen then, since the appellant testified, the appellant could have testified about other things. Here, the court waited until not only the state was complete, but the defense had completed its testimony, and then did it sua sponte without any type of motion by anybody.
Wasn't there a motion for a directed verdict of acquittal?
Yes, there was.
It was then that the district court analyzed the things.
Well, at that point, as I recall, Your Honor, the district court judge does analyze it, I think, fairly insightfully, and says it's an argument you make in your final argument. But then, without any further discussion between the attorneys and the judge just summarily changed the language of the instructions so that it varied from the complaint. So instead of saying on or about April 1, 2015, he said the instruction reads on or before.
But it seems like my impression, and maybe I'm reading the file wrong, but it's my impression that the motion for judgment of acquittal sort of crystallized the issue in the judge's mind. And then it was at that point that he was attempting, at least, to conform the instruction to the evidence that he had heard during the trial.
I haven't interviewed Judge McBride yet.
Well, no, neither have I. But I mean, that's just my impression of it.
I don't know what the judge was thinking. That's one explanation. But unfortunately, he never explained it. And the effect was to completely undermine the defense that up until that time had been presented.
And, you know, and I appreciate we're going to do plain error review of the jury instruction, but it is a fact that, you know, so there was no objection at trial to the that jury instruction. And if it completely undermined the defense that the attorney was arguing, you would think there would have been. So can you help me out? Again, that doesn't affect the plain error review that we're going to do, but I'm just struggling with that.
I anticipated somebody would ask me a question like that, Your Honor. And I would say that this particular issue was given to me by the trial counsel when I met with him. And I know this isn't part of the record, but I asked him, is there something I should be looking for? And he said the judge changed the language of the jury instruction to vary from the language of the complaint. So obviously he felt it made a significant impact on his defense. Why he didn't raise that as an objection at the time, I don't know. Assuming he realized it, at some point he realized it, and I don't know why he didn't raise it at the time. Frankly, I would have constructed the defense a bit differently, but it's easy for me to second guess in hindsight. I just simply can't answer that question. And
thank
my time
you,
has expired.
Thank Bruder, you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Nicholas Hajdukovich. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota. This court should affirm appellant's convictions for first and second degree criminal sexual conduct. And I would like to concentrate, as counsel did, on the first issue raised in counsel's brief, the jury instructions. And as was just noted in a question to counsel, this is a jury instruction issue. Because it's how the jury was instructed about what the state had to prove in terms of the date or date range of the offense. And there was no objection, so it's reviewed under plain error. And Mr. Bruder just informed the court that he was not able to find any case basically closer to this situation than the Guerra case. And as the questions raised by the court bear out, there are extraordinary dissimilarities between Guerra and this case. And I would just point out that I wasn't able to find anything either that was closer than Guerra, and that's probably for a reason, first of all, because the state's position is that the district court did nothing wrong. But I think counsel's admission about not finding anything closer is quite probative on the question of whether any error was plain to begin with. If nobody can find any authority that says a district court can't do what it did, there's no plain error if there was error to begin with. The second thing I want to address with regard to this, though, is that I think counsel's narrative about trial counsel's trial strategy is simply belied by the record in the case. As I went through the counsel's opening statement, obviously made well before these jury instructions, and then the closing argument, they're parallel to each other, which is a sign of good advocacy. Counsel correctly anticipated what his defense would be, and the closing argument is much longer and obviously much more elaborate than the opening statement, which was pretty short. But it's basically just an elaboration of the issues counsel anticipated in his opening statement. So I would submit that counsel intended to try this case all along based, as these cases often are tried, based on arguments that the victims are not credible, there's too many inconsistencies, too many things that just don't quite add up. That's what he said in his opening statement, and that's what his closing argument was all about. So I think it's entirely belied by the record to say that his entire trial strategy was undermined by a jury instruction that he had no problem with the judge giving. That's what actually doesn't add up here, is a claim that the trial strategy was completely undermined. The only thing counsel can point to is the motion for judgment of acquittal. And the motion was somewhat confusing, but I think what it basically adds up to is that the victims testify that they were a certain age when the abuse occurred, and based on what we know their dates of birth are, they couldn't have been that age if the abuse occurred in this Oakdale home. So either the argument was something is just completely off about their testimony, or the state has an established venue. And the judge's ruling was that basically, I can see what you're saying, counsel, but ultimately the testimony was that they were under the statutory thresholds, 13 in the case of KK, 16 in the case of AJ, regardless of whether they may have been wrong or whether there's inconsistencies about their age. They're clearly well under the statutory threshold. And they were quite clear that it happened in this residence in Oakdale in Washington County. And so this is really a credibility issue for the jury to sort out. And I'm not aware of any authority for the proposition that was wrong. And in fact, counsel hasn't raised the judgment of acquittal as an error on appeal here. But the mere fact that counsel raised the issue on judgment of acquittal does not mean that it was his anticipated defense. I mean, you can imagine cases, I've seen cases where prosecutors do things like forget to ask where something happened, or forget to ask, I saw it in case this week, a witness to identify the defendant in court. Counsel may not have been counting on that, but they essentially, to use the football metaphor, they see the fumble and they pick it up. And that's, I think, what counsel was doing here. This was part of his strategy because there was a little bit of inconsistency about ages and how old these victims were when these things happened. And he used that in his closing argument, in fact, although it wasn't a big part of his closing argument. That was mentioned briefly in counsel's closing argument at page, I believe it was 257, yes. That's part of one page of a approximately 16 or 17 page closing argument where he addresses that. And instead, what he addresses for the most part is, again, what he anticipated in his opening statement. Inconsistencies or alleged inconsistencies, unreasonableness in terms of the events that happened, things of that nature. So I don't think it's fair at all to say that this defense was undermined. I think the defense was exactly as it was anticipated by counsel at the beginning of trial. But even setting that aside, there's no authority for the proposition that what the district court did in the jury instructions was incorrect. The district court instructed the jury about this on or before April 2015 for when these offenses had to occur. And the parties all agreed that the events had to have occurred between April of 2014 and April of 2015. If they did indeed occur, because that's when the family lived in this Oakdale residence, and it was that's what the charges encompassed. So everybody litigated the case under that theory, that if the abuse happened, this is the time, the general time frame for when it happened. Unlike the Guerra case, where the district court, by basically expanding the entire scope of the trial to another incident involving different types of guns stolen from a different place, in the middle of the trial, and in fact, I think towards the end of the trial, really did completely change the complexion of the case. And clearly that did prejudice the defense, because everybody was under the assumption that that case was about one thing, and then midstream the judge says, well, actually it's about this other thing too, that involves completely separate incidents and evidence and everything. So that case, I would submit, could hardly be more different than this case where there's a simple jury instruction. One other thing I wanted to point out about the instruction was that the counsel was given a draft of the jury instructions at the end of the second day of trial and told, you know, look over these tonight, let us know tomorrow if you have any problems with it. The judge made his law clerk available before court started the next morning if there were any corrections to be brought to the court's attention. And before the jury was instructed, the judge asked counsel if there were any objections, and counsel said no. And I'd submit, as the court also asked questions about, that if there had been a problem, if it had undermined the defense, counsel would have been raising that issue to the court's attention.
So, counsel, is your position that to the extent that the rule of criminal procedure, Rule 1705, to the extent that applies to this case, that the district court complied with it?
Absolutely, because I don't think the district court amended the complaint in any way, constructive or otherwise.
Right, which would imply that it doesn't apply.
Yes, exactly.
So I appreciate that, but let's just assume for a moment that it did apply. Mm-hmm. Give me your best answer for why it the district court's ruling meets the standard set out in 1705, which I think gets us to the whether the substantial rights
sure.
of the defendant were affected.
Sure, and I think it's well established that the complaint can be amended during trial to conform to the evidence so long as there's no prejudice to the defense based on lack of notice, new charges, things of that nature. And so to the extent it was conforming to the evidence, first of all, which is allowed, and it didn't prejudice the defendant in any way because first and foremost, as I've articulated at great length, I think it's just a false narrative to say that this undermined defense counsel's strategy. I don't think it affected counsel strategy much, if at all, in the case. And secondly, I'd submit that the state presented a relatively strong case in terms of the victim's testimony, the MCRC nurse's testimony, the changes in behavior of the victim KK, which was testified by the nurse, something that is fairly common among children who are sexually abused, how she basically changed her behavior, her looks, everything after this. Appellant's admissions to being alone with KK in his home in Maplewood, which was relationship evidence presented at trial, that he abused her there as well. And that also testimony from, I believe, both KK and her mother, Ms. Conroy, that the appellant treated KK more affectionately than the other children. Again, additional corroboration. The fact that KK and AJ corroborate each other, essentially, and that they both testified about sexual abuse, and the jury believed both of them. And finally, the jury's rejection of the appellant's testimony, in which he denied doing anything wrong, I think presents additional consciousness of guilt evidence. So given all that, this was a strong case, particularly as far as cases like this go. And so I would submit that and under any sort of harmless error or prejudice type of analysis, there really wasn't any. But again, I think the biggest single thing is that it's not simply not true to say that the defense strategy was undermined in this case. I would also submit that, again, there's simply no authority for the proposition that what the district court did was wrong. And so I think appellant has the burden under plain error of establishing error that was plain, as well as that it affected his substantial rights. And the state's position is that none of those three prongs or the fourth prong have been satisfied in this case. So if the court has no additional questions, I would simply ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. Mr. Bruder?
Thank you. As usual, this is going to be something of a scattergun presentation. But first of all, I want to focus on something that the prosecutor said at the conclusion of his oral argument. He characterized this as a strong case. The transcript is sitting over there on my counsel table. It consists of 275 pages, and that is everything. Jury instructions, closing arguments, opening statements, chambers conferences, everything, 245 pages. Anytime the transcript is that thin, it's not a strong case, it's just a short case, and that's all it is. Counsel suggests that because Guerra is not exactly on point, and there is no case exactly on point that either of us could find, that this couldn't be plain error. I hearkened back to something that occurred in my civil procedure classroom in my first year of law school when the professor's hypothetical involved a bailiff being ordered by a judge to take an attorney outside and shoot him because he had annoyed the judge. Now, that would clearly be plain error if a judge ever gave that instruction.
Among other things.
Well, maybe not. But there are no cases that talk about it because it is so plain error, no judge ever says anything like that. My position is pretty much the same here. When the complaint says one thing, to change the language in the instruction is so plain an error that judges just simply don't do that. They take the language of the complaint and they stick it in their jury instructions. This judge chose not to do that. With respect to the argument that this change in the jury instruction didn't affect the defense strategy, counsel notes that the defense counsel's opening statement raises the issue of credibility. Well, first of all, that opening statement consisted of less than 2 pages of the transcript, but he certainly does mention credibility in there. However, the timing is simply one aspect of credibility. Yes, his issue always was the allegations aren't credible. The linchpin of that argument was they aren't credible because they couldn't have occurred during the time frame set forth in the complaint. That was swept away when the judge changed the jury instruction. So even though the general tenor of the defense wasn't changed, the efficacy of the defense was changed, and that is why this isn't harmless error.
Do you think that if the judge had given the instruction on or about April 1st, that the verdict would have been different?
Well, if that were asked me as a witness, I might say it's speculative. But I would hope this. I would hope that the defense, the final argument, would have been far more assertive. As I look at this case, and I don't really know how to articulate this, because I don't want to engage in second-guessing in hindsight. I assume trial counsel, defense counsel was competent. And I assume that he focused his defense on this one particular issue because he felt that was the best way to craft the defense. In the brief, I raised the issue that there simply weren't enough facts to support the conviction involving ARJ.
That's count two now you're talking.
That's count two.
Right.
And I pointed out all of the things that were missing. And essentially, the state's argument is, fine, but none of that was raised at the trial. And I think the reason it wasn't raised at the trial is not because counsel was incompetent, but because counsel decided to focus on something else. And so I don't know what a jury would have done. And I think when we look at harmless error, clearly this court can't guess at what a jury would have done either. But
counsel's not having focused on count two actually seemed to me to make perfect sense. That is to say that if the jury had not convicted on count one, it seems exceedingly unlikely that they would have convicted on count two. And if the jury convicted on count one, as happened, it probably would follow along with count. Count one was where the focus needed to be.
Right, and I accepted that.
That there seems were reasons entirely for, plausible as a defense approach.
Right, I accepted that there were reasons why the defense counsel did what he did. And in the context of this case, when the linchpin of his defense was swept away, can't speculate on what the jury would have done, but they would have had a much better reason for returning a not guilty verdict if that argument could have been made. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Case is submitted, and we'll have our decision out within the statutory time.